think that wire up there looks like maybe a number 6 wire. I don't think it's that heavy, because I look at it, and my drop line to the house here, now, even the drop line to the house here, it goes first to my neighbor, the drop line, and then it jumps across the space between my neighbor's house and my house. These houses are all detached. The drop line then just jumps across from our house, next door house, to my house. So the service pipes that go down face each other across the separation, which is, I think, 15 feet. But that's the way it's laid out here. it looks like, well, it looks like a mess, to tell you the truth, over.
You said one other very interesting statement. In the worst case, if you were running a kilowatt of Morse code, and you're tapping the key, and yes, the house, the lights in your house are going to be dimming a little bit. Are you telling me that if you looked out at the street light in front of the house, you might see an amount of dimming that is corresponding to the Morse code you're sending? Is that what you're saying, Mel? Go ahead.
Yeah, because that's connected there. They ran a cable. How they did this, I remember when they dug up the neighborhood here. They ran a cable right down from the beginning there. They ran a cable and they zigzagged it across the street this way, that way. And I was looking at it, and I said to the guy, you mean if this one cable on the, by the corner here, because that cable drops down and goes underground right there, and the wires then continue up the block. I said, you mean this one cable this is cut, where it goes down underground here on the corner at that pole, all the lights on the street goes out? He said, yep, that's the way they did it, because it's a dead end street, Dick, over.
Wild. I think, in theory, if I'm real good at reading dimming lights, I could stand in your front of house on a dark night, look at the street light dimming, and read the Morse code you're sending. Is that almost true, Mel?
Yeah, anytime anything, you know, the air conditioner is sending, you can see the lights are always all summer long, a pop, pop, pop. You can see your incandescent lamps, you know, all the time popping, because the compressors on the central air conditioners are off the block, are going on and off and on and off and everything. So if you would look at a, if you monitor the AC line, the needle is always flickering, Dick. It's a terrible place here with power. There's been times that I know that some of those central air conditioners, the older ones, were not starting at times, and they were sticking these transformers on there to get the old one, sometimes kicking over, putting those auto transformers on over.
Wow. So you're telling me some of the people running an air conditioner have trouble starting it, and they're using some kind of a step-up transformer that takes the 95 volts coming from Con Ed, steps it up to 120, or takes the so-called 220 from Con Ed and steps it up to 250 in order to make sure the air conditioner will start. The good news is now your air conditioner starts. The bad news is you're presenting a considerably heavier load to that line, and therefore the rest of the people on the block are going to suffer.
Summer, you know, when they start to recycle and with a head pressure, so those compressors got to need a lot of current to get them going. So they stick those auto transformers on there, you know, the three wire transformers stick to pick them up over.
Yeah, there's about three people with questions, and I got one for you first, Mel, and that is, yeah, I can see how your automatic variac thing is a servo mechanism trying to maintain, let's say, 120 volts continuously coming into you. All of a sudden, I've forgotten this great question I was going to ask you. Oh, yes. The more modern air conditioners have much, much higher EER ratings. In other words, they supply the same amount of air conditioning for one quarter, one half, one third the amount of power draw. And in the case of Long Island Power Authority, which used to be called LOCO, for a short period of time they were offering an incentive. If you would install an air conditioner with an EER rating of 12 or above, they gave you a significant number of dollars of rebate. So therefore, they really lowered the total drain of all the air conditioners in my neighborhood by offering that incentive. I'm getting the impression from what you're saying that Con Ed has not yet offered that incentive to make that corrective action on Dover Street. Is that true, Mel?
That's correct, because we had it when we moved in here, the air-conditioned central system here was a water-cooled system. Instead of venting, you know, it was inside the house, in the basement, they had this system. And it was water-cooled, and they said, no, you can't use them anymore. So we dumped that thing. But there was nobody offered us any incentive. I never got a notification of anything like that. But like I say, a lot of the stuff, of course, all been redone mostly. The whole block is a lot of new houses and things, so new systems have gone in. But the electric wiring was put up 1920, and there's nothing been improved on it since then, Dick, over.
Wild. Alan, I think you had a question. Go ahead.
KC2RFN. I was just wondering, Mel, is it your right as a Con Ed customer to have as good a power as any other Con Ed customer, and that you should be entitled to a good flow of current to your house to run whatever appliances and things that you want to run without any problems? Can't you just call them and have them put in the proper equipment to give you put you on par with everybody else?
Comment.
Mel first, and then John in that order. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, that's for instance of all. Somebody built a new house on a block here, and they wanted to put in an elevator system from the basement up to the third floor. I mean, really, you know, people here have really gone off the deep end with some of these homes they built there. You got to see this area. Some of the houses are just out of this world, I guess is the best way to describe them. So they want to put this in, and they need three phases. But they don't come up to them. Con Ed says, no way, they won't touch nothing. Don't ask for three phases. What you see is what you get. Over.
Okay, Deirdre. Okay, John and Eric in that order. Go ahead, John.
Yes, Mel can do this. If not, public service can help him. But Edison will come to your location, and they will put in a Dutch clock, and they will take readings. And if your power is under what they are supposed to guarantee delivered to you, they will, if they have to, change every wire on the block. They will do that. And Con Edison is changing distribution over. We used to have 4160. They're getting rid of that totally. We're basically at 13.8 for low-level distribution. 35 kV is the new distribution, and you will see that on top of many of the poles in New York now. They're set up in a delta fashion down at the very top of the pole. So that's what you're seeing. And, Mel, I'm surprised three phase, because it's only three stories. They can get a hydraulic elevator that should operate on single phase. They should look into that possibly. But just a quick comment for you guys. Back to you, Dave.
KC2QAQ with Kevin.
Okay, yes. Thank you, John. Eric next, and then Glenn after that. Go ahead, Eric.
Two things. What kind of a regulator you got there, Mel? Is that a Statco? Because they make a lot of stuff, which looks like variacs on a shaft with motors. I have a couple of big ones at work. As far as Con Ed and EER rebates, electric equipment must be purchased June 1st, 2009, December 1st, 2011 to be eligible. They offer financial incentives if you want to do central air conditioning or you buy EER air conditioners. They give you rebates that run from $25 to $400. So, yeah, Con Ed does offer, and I've used it, so... EER is over than 12, or even over 13. Actually, the higher the number, the more they give you. And if you buy central air conditioning, they give you a whole lot of stuff. But there you go. K2IW, K2J.
Eric, are you saying that there is an incentive with Con Ed throughout the five boroughs of New York City active right now for a person who buys a high EER number air conditioner, like central air conditioner? Over to you, Eric.
Yeah, that's why I'm saying that, and I believe they have a website that you can go to that you can actually fill out the form, and give me a minute and I'll come up with it.
Interesting. Glenn, KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, sure, Dick. I just wanted to mention that, you know, the electrical standards, what they actually have to meet is not, it's really kind of loose, and most new modern equipment today is able to handle the full line swings, but unfortunately, you know, line voltages can swing with dips and droops to 136 volts and as low as 108, you know, here in this area. So your equipment really does have to, you know, the line's neutral voltage, and of course, you know, the 220 basically just multiply that by two. So you can see it's really quite a swing, and it's as modern equipment today doesn't have too much trouble with it, but some of the older devices, you might have to get some power conditioning circuits for it in order to handle it properly. KC2QIQ.
You want the website?
Yeah, go ahead with the website, Eric.
Oh, by the way, we're right next to the generating station and the substation here, and this is the area that blacked out for 2 weeks, and, you know, we don't have power. Although I did. I brought my generator along, but we wound up with a whole new system here. I used to get voltages as low as like 70 volts and as high as 140, and now it seems to be constant all through the summer. It's pretty amazing. But anyway, the site is ConEdHVACRebates, all one word, .com. ConEdHVACRebates.com.
And I presume there's a www in front of ConEd. Go ahead.
Yeah, you can assume that. Most browsers don't require the www, but yeah, you can put the www in front of it.
Okay, that's good to know. But I think, Glenn, you'd recognize the fact that when Mel has measured his voltage as low as 95 or 97 volts, one line to ground, one line to neutral, I think he's outside of the range of anyone would consider acceptable voltage. So I think there's possibly a way that his 1920s wiring for his particular community could be updated. What do you think, Glenn?
I think all that Mel would have to do is just prove to them that the power is below 108 for any length of time, and they have to do something. KC2QIQ.
And you see it the same way, Eric?
Well, before the entire system burned up because somebody at the control center wasn't very smart, and, you know, they never actually told the truth about it, but we knew a couple people that worked there, and they told us the whole story, but they used to complain a lot, and they basically would come and measure it. Of course, when the, you know, when it wasn't the maximum load time, it wasn't the time that they switch over because it's the middle of the summer and everybody came home and turned their air conditioners on. They are pretty resistant to doing anything about it in this area specifically because it's all underground. But when they finally got forced into changing it, it made a world of difference.
Nothing here in Brooklyn.
I'll bet you there's a way, if you cared enough, Mel, that you and your neighbors could get together, sign a petition, and you're the guy that can supply the measurements traceable to the Bureau as to what AC voltage is being supplied for what period of time, run a strip chart recorder, whatever. I think you've got more than enough reason to make a formal complaint and get corrective action for your 1920s wiring. I think it's time you guys be brought up to the 21st century. Now, whether or not you want to get that politically active between you and all of your neighbors and make all of that change, where you're the guy who has the ability to correct much of the problem within his house, within your particular house, maybe you don't want to get involved. But from what I'm hearing, Mel, you've got more than enough reason for making that complaint. KE2EJ, K2R, here we go, K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Let me tell you something, Dick. We had a situation here some years ago. The neutral line up on the top line of the three is neutral. The neutral line sagged so bad that sometimes when the wind would blow, it hit one of the 110 lines, and you see some beautiful arcs here. Then we had another problem down in the corner. There was a one of the insulators was popping every so often. And, they come along, nice day today, what's the complaint here? I said, see that neutral line over there, it arced and everything like that. I don't see no arc. Tell them that's about the insulator, we'll take care of it, never did it. The light was out, front light was out on the street here, was out for 3 weeks. I can tell you, the services here just stink. That's the bottom line. No matter what you need, let me drop it. I'll give you one instance after another. Tree limb broke down here, came down, blocked the street. Fire department comes, they pulled the tree limb over so it blocked my driveway. I said, how am I supposed to get the car in and out? Not our problem. I said, what do you mean not your problem there? You pulled the tree limb over to block my driveway. I was standing there. The fire department said, well, get yourself somebody that, that takes care of down tree limbs or whatever. Call the parks department. How about 3 months? That's exactly what they said. I got out my chainsaw and I cut it up. The logs laid here, right in front. Big logs. They laid here 3 months. Honestly, I had to clean up the whole mess with all the leaves and everything. Nothing will be done. I'll tell you another one we're going through right now.
KC2QAQ with a comment.
Glenn's on the list, but go ahead, Mel.
Okay, now with the traffic department. We have a main street here, and there's accidents one after another. In fact, in the summertime, they have the patio door open. You see, 2 o'clock in the morning, you hear the wheels squeak because it's a straight run about 1 mile here. And it's a racetrack. That's it, a speedway where these kids test their cars of speed. Well, anyhow, somebody, unfortunately, had a very bad accident here. About 3 weeks ago, a little kid, 4 years old, got killed. Mother ran out after the child, ran out to the traffic there, and was hit also, but I think she survived, but the child was crushed. And because the speed limit is 35, but even the buses go faster. So they got a traffic light here. They're pulling. They've been doing this for 5 years, fighting with the traffic department to make that thing a regular operating light. So far, still nothing is done. So I can tell you, here we go. This is part of the Manhattan Beach Improvement Group and all. I said, but I'm tired of going to their meetings and getting no results. Over.
I can add to that. Wow. You guys are being treated like second-class citizens. There's an injustice here. We got Glenn and Eric in that order. KC2QIQ, go ahead, Glenn.
Well, I can share a little bit with Mel's pain. One of the problems I had here was I had a telephone pole outside the front of the house with a drop line that would arc every time there was a rainstorm. And I kept on calling up LIPA and mentioning to them that this is going to be a problem, it's going to be a problem. And sure enough, 1 January last year, it went out, and basically all the power dropped here in the house. I had a backup and going generator, and it took them, because it was a weekend when I called in the issue, it took them almost like a day to come by. So we were without, utility power, and I was on generator for almost a day and a half. Let me let it drop for a second. Now, mind you, for almost 2 years I was calling them about this problem. Finally, they did come in almost 2 days later to fix my drop line in January in the middle of an ice storm. And by this point, they cut the line, not only in the street where it was defective, but they also cut the drop line, so they had to replace the drop line. Okay, not so bad, so now I've got a new drop line. Then they cut the wires going into my drop to my service, and then I had to get an electrician to fix it within 5 days with a certificate, otherwise they were threatening of cutting off the electricity again because of improper wiring on the house. KC2QIQ.
I think it's time for all of you guys to start writing a couple of letters to the editor of your local major newspaper. You guys have got some stories here that really should be made a little bit more public. Do you think that will give us any action, Eric? KE2EJ, KQRIW in the second end?
Now, the folks around here are pretty active. We do petitions. We do a lot of things. We even try to get rid of our mailman. Our mailman consistently delivers the wrong mail to the wrong house and seems to lose a lot of it. And yet the post office won't do a lot about it. I mean, we're now writing letters to the Postmaster General. But anyway, there's a whole section of the street after this power failure where you can actually see the insulation has fallen off the lines. The lines are literally dripping into each other. They occasionally whack each other And Con Ed says, you know, no problem. And it's been like that for the last 5 years or so. When the whole thing finally rocks off and melts and falls into the ground, then they'll do something about it. And with the Poskapine, you know, with Windstorm, we lost a bit of a tree, and, you know, it was all across the front. Oh, yeah, we'll get to it. So I pulled my chainsaw out, and the lumber is still sitting out there. They'll probably come in another week or two. And the other thing you got to be careful about with the Parks Department, if you fix your sidewalk, but you're responsible for it, even though it's not your property, and you just actually nip a root and the tree falls over, the Parks Department will sue you.
For comment, I'm pushing for the comment. I don't know if it's a full set of call letters. It sounds like it could be Ed. Go ahead, Ed.
Yes, it's Ed, K2GJE. I just have a comment on using an abandoned coax. What about the safety of the lineman climbing that pole? He doesn't expect that tail to be live. It also might be an insurance liability problem, over.
Bear in mind now that a couple of hours per day, worst case, Alan is going to put a few watts of RF energy onto that cable. A person touching that cable wouldn't be damaged by that. He's not putting live 110 volts or 220 volts on the line. So that's not quite as bad as it sounds. On top of that, in order for the, even if Alan was running, let me pick a number, 150 watts, and he's running key down, the guy is not going to grab onto that wire and hold onto it for 6 minutes, so to speak. The heating you get from something that's a source of RF energy is a thermal heating that takes a certain amount of time to happen, and the guy would know that his hand is starting to feel warm, and he would naturally let go of it. So I think the chances of Alan running into a problem on that are quite slim. Not zero, but he's a fairly careful guy. And so what he's going to do is to look outside at that particular utility pole, make sure that nobody is doing any service the next time he does some transmitting. We got to move on. George, I better go to George first. He's been waiting patiently. I wonder if George is still with us. N2 Hotel Oscar, K2RIW. Go ahead with your question, George. My name is Dick.
Okay, good evening, everybody. This is November 2, Hotel Oscar. unfortunately, listening all these stories about this power and other problems, you know, I used to live in the former Soviet Union, you know, and the longer I live here, it's more and more resembles of the problems we had over there, where government was in the control of everything. Okay? Okay, but actually, I have a question from a completely different area. Just recently I purchased the kit for digital vector RF wattmeter from NALP, Larry Fipp. I don't know if you're familiar with this type of this instrument. It was a kit and I put everything together and it worked beautifully. Larry calibrated it for me. Now, I connected it between my transmitter and the antenna, and this unit gives me a wealth of information, actually. It's forward power, reflected power, SWR value, and all these parameters like G, R, X, which is reactance, you know, and the phase. Now, my question is, I try to understand how can I use, except of SWR, of course, how can I use these values of impedance, active part, reactive part, what to do with it antenna-wise? I mean, do I need to do something with my antenna to bring down the reactive part, which I can, you know, I can see on this meter, or anyway, I don't know what to do with it. That's the question. Back to the dick.
Very fine, George. Boy, those guys in Oceanside have got some really nice equipment. What you've got there, George, that sounds like one hell of an instrument. That's almost a poor man's vector network analyzer with all that information it gives you. Forward reflected power, Z, R, X, phase, standing wave ratio. Wow. The situation you've got there, George, is a little bit like that old advertisement for the New York Times. And the New York Times used to claim, you don't have to read it all, but it's nice to know it's all there. And that was their advertisement. You don't have to use it all. It's nice to know it's all there. George, if you were designing an antenna, or if you were experimentally setting up a random length of wire, a dipole that zigzags in a funny way, and if you already know by way of some other measurements with that exact machine of yours, by disconnecting and putting an open circuit, a short circuit, or a 50-ohm load at the far side of your transmission line, then connect your unknown antenna. By knowing the X value, the phase value, the R value, when you are smart enough, and I didn't say you have to go this way, but if you want to study it, let me drop. Those extra values will tell you right off the bat, once you know how to interpret them, it'll tell you your antenna is too long, it's too short, the impedance is too high, the impedance is too low, you can figure out it's too close to the ground, too far from the ground compared to the original design. As you sweep the antenna and you look at the rate of change of all those values, it is valuable information. I didn't say it's easy to use. It's going to take some study. But if you wanted to really start using all that beautiful information that that machine is giving you, it would allow you to do some very good antenna design. As an occupation, I do antenna design, and people pay me money to do that. And as such, those are the exact values I want to know, because it's a little bit like a blind man walking up a hill, so to speak. By way of what you feel in your feet, you know which way is uphill. By the same token, by knowing the rate of change and the magnitude of Z, R, X, and phase, it tells you which way to go. Do you make the antenna longer or shorter, fatter or skinnier, wider in this location? Do you put an impedance matching device? All of that information is valuable information once you learn how to use it. Your next question, let me drop. Your next question is going to be, okay, what website do I go to and what book do I read to learn how to use those factors? And that's a little bit tough. I'm going to keep an eye out for those kind of articles that help. You do know that Z is total impedance. But Z is made up of two components. Z consists of R and X. R really means what's the resistive component, and phase-wise at right angles to that, what is the reactive component? And by knowing the length of line and the way the transmission line changes impedances, that instrument will allow you to electronically act as if you're making the measurements right at the antenna at the far end of your transmission line, once you know what is the length of your transmission line. So I am saying that's very valuable information. It's going to take quite a bit of study to learn how to use it. It's sort of like somebody has given you a really good book that's in French, and now you have to learn how to read French. Maybe not a good example, but be happy you've got it. You've now got a toy that can keep you off the streets for a long time, George, and make all the people in Oceanside say, man, that guy George, he really knows what's going on. N2 Hotel Oscar, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, because it's funny, but it gives me more information than I can, you know, digest. It even can be connected to the computer and plot the Smith chart and some other graphs, you know, in graphical interpretation. It's a very interesting instrument. Probably I understand, like you say, if you design an antenna, probably I need to connect this instrument directly to the antenna to measure all these parameters, because otherwise everything is like in front of it. I mean, the unknown to me, like line which I have here, like coax cable, which I have to probably put the 50 ohm termination at the end of this coax cable and see what this coax cable is all about. Maybe it's not as good as I think it is. So far I only found out that I have some dummy loads, homemade, and only my 50 ohm dummy load more or less is acceptable, I mean, through the range of the frequencies from 1.8 to 30 megs. The two others I made, they are very bad. I mean, 1.9 megs is fine, but when you go up to, I don't know, 14, 20 megs, it's completely not those values of impedance which I expected to see. Anyway, so now now I'm on, in the process of buying a pretty reliable dummy load, because I understood that whatever I have here is not really good to continue. Okay, back to you, Dick.
Question. Yeah, person with question, get to you in a second. George, as I said, the nicest way to measure an antenna, if you could do it, would be to climb to the top of the tower, the top of the chimney, wherever the transmission line ends, and make the measurements right there. Obviously, it's very inconvenient. By way of measurements you can make with that beautiful instrument of yours in the shack, and by putting alternately a short and open and a dummy load at the end of your cable, and sweeping it and making recordings of those measurements, you can electronically, mathematically, make all the measurements you want in the shack, and it will tell you exactly what measurements you would have gotten had you made all the measurements at the top of the transmission line, right at the antenna. All of those measurements you can make with that instrument allow you to do that. I didn't say it's easy. It's going to take some study, but you've got one hell of a toy there. The person with the question, start off with your call letters and your name, and go right ahead with your question on this subject. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Yeah, you didn't recognize me. That's good. Okay, Wesley, and to XVM. The question is, what is the model number, what did you buy it, and how much it cost? Сколько это стоило эти это покупало?
Will you be 2HWW with a question on this subject?
Yes, stand by, Howie. George, look what you've created here. Look at the problem you created, George. You're going to make Wesley spend even more money. Go ahead and hit George. He wants to know the model number, and I do too. Sounds like a beauty. And model number in dollars. N2HO, you got it, George.
Okay, the model number is LP, like Lima Papa, -100A, as in Apple. And this guy, Nancy 8, Lima Papa, this is the author of this actual instrument, and he's manufacturing this kit. He has the kit, and he has the built already completed unit. And he guarantees that it's traceable to National Institute of Standards. The homepage of this guy is HTTP, semicolon, colon, double slash www.telepostinc.com. Telepost is like TELEPOSTINC.com. And you can read all about it on this website. The instrument comes with like a kit, and you have to have certain skill to put it together, because it's not really for beginners, you know, just in case. The kit costs $335. The assembled unit costs $435 or something like this, dollars, plus shipping. And Larry, the manufacturer, you can calibrate it by yourself, or you can send it back to him, and he does the job for free, and you only pay for shipping. That's probably all. I probably answered the question. Back to you.
You sure did, George. Good information. Wow. That is quite an instrument you've got there. Howie, what's your question on this one?
Well, actually, the question is, I was at Richie's house today. I don't know if Richie's on frequency. We were using the MFK antenna analyzer to make a stub, and we were getting some erroneous readings. If you don't mind, I can give a little explanation on this, and maybe you can make a comment, because it really stumped me today what was going on. I think the unit wasn't calibrated right or something.
Howie, I'm putting you on the list, because we've got one other guy, Bill, who's been patiently waiting, and I've been promising Mel we're not going to keep his guys up too late. Let me go over to Mel right now. Mel, if you've got one of your youngster questioners that you think we should be handling, go right ahead. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay.
opposed to what we've just been discussing. I've got, yes, from this young, like I say, I'm looking at only the newcomers to ham radio, mostly younger people. And one posed a question. He says, I've asked my friends if we neither or none of us seems to be able to come up with an answer. We're looking to buy tuners, and we noticed that most of them say they use a circuit type T network, but others are using an L network. They all seem to have cross-needle design and built-in Balaam of 4-to-1. Power-wise, they handle the same approximately power. They manufacture planes of matching range, seem to be similar. Why or what is the advantage for one over the other, whether it's T-network or L-network? Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, that's a darn good question. And there's no good answer for it that I think of. If I've got a minimum of two variable reactances, I've got two variable capacitors, I've got two variable inductors, I've got a variable inductor, a variable capacitor. If I've got the right combination of two objects and I set them up in an L configuration, I can match a very large range of all the possible impedances, which could be represented on the Smith chart. A T network, I think, has got a little bit more range than an L network, if you're not willing to change it. Now, an L network, if I'm willing to reverse who's the input, who's the output, which component is on top, which component's on the bottom, if you know what I mean, if I've got that kind of versatility, an L network gives you almost everything. So I think the real question here is how much versatility of either of those designs has the manufacturer given you? And I wish these guys would, I wish these guys would really give you the information in user, engineering user-friendly form. The most friendly form I can think of. And I've seen a couple of articles that tell you how to set up L networks and how to set up T networks. There was an article in Microwaves and RF, about 2 years ago, year and a half ago, in which they did what I'm saying is the right way to do it. They literally showed you a Smith chart. They colored in the areas where that particular circuit would cover. And if your particular impedance of your antenna and your transmission line fell into that colored in area of the Smith chart, then you know that this circuit would give you a perfect match at that frequency. So these manufacturers really should say, give you a Smith chart, a graph. Because to say that it'll solve any 4-to-1 is nowhere near enough information. It's some information, but nowhere near enough. In other words, for all possible phase angles, it'll always match a 4-to-1. But there are certain phase angles where it'll match a 10-to-1. If that was represented on a Smith chart, that would be very useful information. And I think almost none of the antenna tuners have done it that way. So the best you and I can recommend beyond that, I think, Mel, is very similar to a guy who says, should I buy brand A or buy brand B of transceiver? And there's no easy answer to that. The specifications that are in the write-up in QSC give you some aid, but the best you can probably do is to talk to your friends and find out who likes it, who has had it for a year and loves it, who has had it for 1 month and hates it, if you know what I mean. Word of mouth among us amateurs saying what they like and what don't like is a little bit more valuable than selecting key.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Simply selecting T or L is a little bit like what your wife will laugh at me. Should I marry a blonde, a brunette, or a redhead? Well, there's a lot more variables involved. The same thing with T and L. How that guy implemented it and how far is the range of those variable controls, again, really dictates how much of the chart he covers. However, you don't have to buy something that's perfect. If the particular tuner you buy only covers two-thirds of the Smith chart of all possible impedances, once you get enough knowledge and you realize that your antenna falls into the one-third that's not covered, by adding an extra length of feed line, maybe of a slightly different impedance, will rotate your impedance to the good area of the Smith chart where your antenna tuner will cover it. So even if the antenna tuner you buy is nowhere near good enough, if you're a little bit smart, a crafty guy like those guys in Manhattan Beach, I guarantee they can find a way of using almost any antenna tuner that works at all. K2KEY, K2RIW in the tech pad.
Yes, this is K2KEY. Well, the L network tuners that they've been offering looks like from the manufacturers and from what QSP has reviewed, I remember the review on tuners a number of times, seems like the L network tuners have a much more wider matching range, somewhere in the neighborhood from about 5 ohms to about 3,000 ohms. So I guess you can't go wrong with the L network. Of course, the L network tuner also, in some cases, people like it because it only has two knobs, whereas the T network has three, has the capacitor, inductor, capacitor, whereas the L network ones only have an inductor, variable inductor, and a capacitor. So, again, you know, it's up to, I could say, the individual. What else can I say about it? I was going to say something else, but, I could say, if you go back, I'm going to drop.
Network.
Okay, if you go back to, I could say, the tutelage that we did on the Smith chart, you could easily see where your particular antenna falls into what kind of a range, and then they'll get looking at the tuner. You can most likely see where the settings have to be approximately. The very good source, somebody asked before about, you know, sophisticated instrument, understanding all the magnitudes that you can measure on these instruments. I have several of those instruments. Rather than all combined in one, it's spread over a number of the instruments. The antenna handbook, the ARRL handbook, I think does a fairly good job in the first few chapters there, Dick, on understanding, you know, reactants, resistance, reactants, and so on and so forth. So I think that's a pretty good place to start, Dick, over.
Okay, if a manufacturer of an antenna tuner tells you it'll match from 3 ohms to 1,000 ohms, in theory, he's only telling you the resistive component impedance matching range. If my 50 ohm antenna, I'd like it to be 50 ohms because that's the cable I'm using, for some reason went down to 3 ohms and up to 1,000, they're telling you the antenna tuner will handle that. Well, that's only a fraction of the story. My antenna could be a 50 ohm resistor, which just happened to also have somewhere between 3 and 1,000 ohms of capacitive reactants or inductive reactants. And the reactance is usually up and down on the Smith chart, and the resistance is left and right. So you really need the combination, which is fill in the area on the Smith chart. So telling you it'll match 3 to 1,000, that statement itself is not giving you enough information. If they told you it'll match a 3 to 1,000 of all possible phase angles of reflection coefficient, wow. Now he's just covered up 90% of the Smith chart, if you know what I mean. But as you can tell, they didn't fill in the rest of that sentence. So it's telling you something, but not enough, as I see it. There's more to the story than first meets the eye. So people who are hearing about impedance, reactance, susceptance, conductance, impedance, conductance, all of these fancy words that describe the way the antenna loads your transmission line. And is, eight words or so altogether. And they've all got individual meanings which have purpose on some particular method of analysis. The first time a person gets hit with all these crazy words, it is overwhelming.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Without a doubt, it is overwhelming. I was a number of years downrange in engineering school before some of those words started making meaning to me, because I didn't study them thorough enough, early enough. And the first time I started reading a few ham radio articles, I delved into some of that. It wasn't easy. So if you're a little bit frustrated when you hear those words the first time, you're in good company. By way of all the data and all of the instructions and whatever that you can find on the internet and in the right kind of books and talking to people, you'll eventually figure it out. It's just one more big mystery. It's an investment you've got to make. When you do make the investment to understand these things, to learn them, it is valuable. You use it for the rest of your life. In my opinion, it's a good investment. Just like if you're going to be living in Europe, to learn to speak French and German could be very valuable. If you're going to be a ham radio operator, to learn those words, even though they're difficult at first, I think it's a very good investment. I wonder if you want to go to one more of those mailbag questions, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW. We're backed up at least a week or two here.
Want to ask a question on the antenna tuners, please?
Go ahead, Howie.
Covered L and a T. What do you think of a Pi network, the old-fashioned, you know, C1, L1, C2, you know, your input tuning and your loading capacitor, and if you have the three adjustments, you have a tap coil and then two capacitors. What do you think of that particular configuration for a tuner, for a balanced tuner, coax?
You said balanced tuner and you said coax, which is unbalanced, but I know what you mean. Pi, T, L, L pi, L T, and so on. All kinds of combinations. Each has its advantages and disadvantages. For simplistic reasons, on a pi final stage of an amplifier, the C1 capacitor is called tuning, the C2 capacitor is called loading, but there's a catch. Those are oversimplifications. There's a significant amount of interaction between those controls. You turn that C2 capacitor and you think you're only changing the loading. To a small degree, you're changing the tuning at the same time. Yes, I will admit that the C2 capacitor, when you change it, I'm going to pick numbers out of the air, maybe 75% of what you're doing is changing the loading and 25% is changing the tuning. And when you change the C1 capacitor, 75% of what you're doing is changing the tuning and 25% of what you're doing is changing the loading. So to call them tuning control and loading control is an oversimplification. What else is new? Is pi better than T, better than L? Is a blonde better than a redhead, better than a brunette, or better than a brown-haired lady? A lot more variables involved than first meet the eye. So there's no simple answer to that. The biggest good and badness of an antenna tuner is a function of what's the range of the components, what's the power rating of the components, and how well was it configured by that particular manufacturer? How user-friendly is it? These might be slightly more important factors than whether it has the particular schematic of pi, T, L, or some other combination. So I wish there was a nice simple answer to that one, Howie. I don't think it's quite that simple. If someone thinks that
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
If someone thinks that there is a more simple way of explaining it, give me your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2QIQ with a comment question.
There's a guy who's...
Just my comment is, I've always liked the Pi network, you know, C1, L1, C2, like the Merch tuners or the Johnson tuners.
Because you've got experience with them and you get a warm, fuzzy feeling, you like it, and I understand that. Glenn's built a number of tuners in his day, and I bet you he's got his favorite. Go ahead, Glenn. Wait for the beep.
Well, I like the L with the, the L filter, and then also with an inductor that you can kind of zero out. So that's kind of nice. Actually, the one that I use presently right now is a kind of a modified, but it's an MFJ989D. It's really in the same original configuration. It's just that a couple things I had to beef up. But my question for you, Dick, is that one thing I've always been unhappy with that tuner is the roller inductor. And, it's basically a 90-turn inductor, And I've read so much about them where, you know, there's a whole bunch of different styles that, you know, if you go, depending on how the inductor is wired, it can arc and cause other issues. And, you know, the ones that there are roller inductors that actually short themselves out as they go along. I was wondering if you had some words of wisdom on the roller inductors, because they always put my head in a spin to find out what would actually be the ultimate roller inductor for a antenna tuner. KC2QIQ.
Whenever you have RF energy flowing through a sliding or rolling contact, and you're running it at anything more than a few watts of power, in my mind, you're in trouble. If you're at the 100-watt or the 1,000-watt level, and you've got sliding, contacting surfaces with RF energy flowing through them, if you looked at that at the microscopic level, as those pieces of metal are bouncing along the individual microscopic hills and valleys, all kinds of slip and stick and welding and all kinds of sparking and arcing are going on at the microscopic level. It is not a reliable thing. When I first came out with the strip line parallel kilowatt amplifier for 432, that's that article way back in the dark ages of April and May 1972, QFC. You can look at the QFC archives and you can see it. It has no, it's the first tunable microwave high power circuit, kilowatt circuit, that I know of, that had no sliding contacts. It bends pieces of metal instead of sliding them, and you get tremendous amounts of reliability, repeatability, and non-failure. No matter how big your screw thread is, no matter how big your roller, no matter how big your slider is, as it has more and more silver plating, which is going to wash away, as it's got bigger and bigger contacts, you're still got someday going to get the galling and welding and whatever of those contacts as you move it with RF energy flowing through it. If you're a super, let me drop. If you're a super conservative guy and always turn off the transmitter and you're starting off with a roller inductor that's got really nice, fresh, thick silver plating, which is nice and clean, and you roll the roller inductor while the transmitter is off, let it settle mechanically to a new position, then turn on the transmitter, you could avoid this problem. But operating in that manner is one heck of a pain in the tail. We all want to press down the key and turn the controls and watch what's happening in order to tune for the null or the peak or whatever. So sliding contacts are a no-no in my mind. I would rather have an inductor that has taps on it and a real good mechanical switch. But even there, don't operate the mechanical switch while the RF energy is flowing. So in either case, if you've got sliding, contacting, rolling, whatever, don't do it with high-power RF flowing through that junction. It's just a matter of time before it gives you trouble, in my mind. KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Dual
flexor
with power.
Yeah, I think you've said a mouthful there, Dick. You know, that's really an incredible thing, because one piece of advice maybe to give the youngsters maybe who are first trying the antenna tuners and things are that if they're going to use the roller inductors, keep their eye on them all the time, because I think that's one thing inside a inside an antenna tuner that probably always is going to require some kind of maintenance and, you know, could really run them afoul. Well, like you're saying, always be careful, you know, and if you're going to tune it, if anything, maybe another practice is always tune under very, very low power first before you bring up the power to give it a little bit more longevity. But I agree with you there, Dick, 100% on that one, KC2QIQ.
Hey, you want to go to one more mailbag mail, K2KEY, K2LIW?
Yeah, this is K2KEY. You know, just one final comment. Yeah, we're going to lose the audience anyhow in a couple of minutes. 10 o'clock is the cutoff time. So, the only thing they're offering right now, believe it or not, the tuners, I was just looking now, look back, found the article in QST. If you want to read about tuners, the review that QST did on all the popular, the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, manufacturers of the five manufacturers of the most popular tuners right now on the market. February 2003, QST, all reviewed in there. They're all based on using a rotary inductor. They're all rated at power levels of, well, 3,000 watts, things like that, all using rotary inductors. Dick, that's the only thing you're going to find, I believe, on the market right now. Over.
Okay, even though they've got a rotary inductor, if you know ahead of time, regardless of what the manufacturer said, that when you're putting a kilowatt of power through that while you're rolling the roller inductor, and if you can think microscopically, make believe you've got a microscope right at that rolling contact, and you've got two pieces of metal which microscopically have hills and valleys, and they're bouncing and sliding across each other while high power RF energy is flowing through that junction. At the microscopic level, you are arcing and sparking and doing all kinds of nasty things. You're eating up the silver plating and so on. You're going to shorten the life of your roller ductor if you roll it with power. If you want your roller ductor to last much, much longer, either tune it up at low power or roll it, then turn on the power, turn the power off, roll it, turn the power back on, and so on. It's the it is the combination of high power with velocity of rolling that creates the arcing and sparking and damage, which more rapidly eats up the silver plating, and eventually you're down to some pretty scratchy contacts, and as you 3 years downrange, you roll your roller inductor while you're watching the needles, and you watch the needles move in a very erratic manner because you're making a sloppy, erratic contact. It's inevitable. There is no avoiding that. So once you know about it ahead of time, you can take corrective action and double and triple the life of that particular component of your tuner if you so desire to do so. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yeah, Roger, this is K2KEY. Well, that's why I usually suggest to them, get one of those handheld antenna analyzers. In other words, that becomes your radio, your rig. You put that in place of your rig and do the tune-up with the tuner on that particular band with that instrument. And then when you hook it to your rig, it should be really no adjustment, really. Maybe you may have to touch the capacitors up a little bit, but I doubt most likely it's going to need any major retuning. So with that method, like you say, you'll protect the rotary inductor from any kind of damage. And the rotary inductors, I have a couple of them, surplus ones, which were made a little bit better, maybe, because some other way they construct them. But as far as the ones that right now are being offered, that's the best advice I can give is first tune it up with these handheld or very, very low power radios and make notes that, of course, the dials have numbers on them and the rotary inductor has a counter. You know, make notes so that if you change bands, you know where to come back to then, over.
Casey, 2QNQ with one more comment.
Go ahead, Glenn.
I just really would like to reinforce what Mel was saying because it's really important, and a lot of people really don't pay attention to that. And what Mel was really saying, that's really the right way to tune up, because anybody who's ever tuned along the HF bands and listens along, you'll hear a beautiful, you know, conversation going on in the background. And then you've got what everybody refers to as the tune-up guy. So in the middle of everyone's cue, so there's somebody in the background tuning up, and you hear that awful tone in the background. But meanwhile, if you just followed the procedure that Mel had just mentioned right there, you would never know what was going on in the background, and then when the person comes in, they can identify themselves and join the conversation without having to listen to that awful CW tune-up tone in the background, KC2, QIQ.
When you get down to the last little bit of tuning of, say, for instance, an afterburner, you can do a lot of the tuning at low power, and in some cases into a dummy load instead of your antenna, if you really know what your antenna is. And if you're really smart, you can force your dummy load to act exactly like the antenna. You can add slight tuning devices to your dummy load so it acts like the antenna. Therefore, when you tune into the dummy load, it's identical to tuning into the antenna, and you're not creating interference on the air. But if your amplifier is capable of 1,000 watts of output, for instance, and you did the tuning at the low power level, you'll end up with the 95% tune point, so to speak. Under real high-power operation, where the power supply fades a little bit and so on, that last little bit of tuning can give you another 5% of power or bandwidth or whatever. So maybe what a guy should do is